Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the teachers' union in Washington, D.C. says the Washington Post is one lying newspaper. And who really owns Africa when African heads of state have to ask Europeans for permission to fly over the continent?
But first, it's getting harder and harder to tell the difference between a Democratic budget and a Republican budget. Could it be that by accepting the idea that the nation's number one problem is the deficit, President Obama is in principle agreement with Republicans? We asked Thomas Ferguson, professor at the University of Massachusetts.
Basically, yes, that's certainly correct. You know, more broadly, I'd say he's just been following a general strategy of agree with the Republicans at almost every point all through his time in power. The true failure of the administration, now let's get clear, has been on economic policy, because when they did their initial government stimulus program, they came in half as high as they should have. That's failed now. And you've got, you know, you're after 2 years in power, more than 2 years in power, they own this recession, and the failure there is immense, and I have a bad feeling we're going to live with it for a generation, because what's happened is it's been used to discredit the whole idea of government acting on the economy. I mean, it's really tragic in the sense that Obama was elected with people thinking they were going to have a transformative presidency on the model of the New Deal. And instead, they got what's really a liberal Republican administration.
Obama seems not even in a mood to speak of stimulus.
Well, at this point, I can see they've got a problem. On the other hand, nobody was in a mood, one would have said, that even the day before the election in 2010, to sort of do another giant tax cut, especially for the rich. But, you know, he turned right around afterward and did it. And he did it in the name of actually stimulus. I mean, it was defended in part by the claim that it would make a shaky recession less likely to come back into another problem. This guy's not only, if you like, mistaken, he's also unlucky in the sense of the gas price rise. You know, this is big enough now to threaten, I think, even his reelection. I mean, that's basically the import of the way you look at these polls. In the history of gas price rises, presidential popularity is quite striking, and it's always the same. They really turn people off.
Since the midterm elections, what has Obama done that is redeeming in the area of the economy?
This is slightly complicated. If I could, just, it is true. It's not the way I would have done it, nor the best way to do it. But if you were trying to keep the recovery going, you know, doing the tax cuts he did, they didn't have to be done that way. You could have done, for instance, some extra spending and kept the money to pay for it with that, and you would have been better off. I mean, there was some logic, however weak, to the tax cut bill, and the unemployment compensation parts of that that went through in the same bill were certainly, people needed those extensions. Because a lot of folks, you know, you got very high long-term rates of unemployment. Those aren't coming down anytime soon. But, you know, basically, I'm in entire agreement with you. He hasn't done much. And, you know, I have to say, everything that's happening has really sort of got this, it's shadowed by this large cloud, which is the guy's got to raise $1 billion, they think, in order to run for re-election. And so, you know, everything the White House does is coming through that prism. And the basic formula here is very clearly you target the rich. I mean, we have, you know, a money-driven election system that has now reached insanity. It's not just Citizens United, the famous court decision that said you can actually just open your corporate treasuries directly and hand it out to political candidates. But that's part of it. So you got everybody in both political parties looking around, just saying, how do I raise yet more money? I had a congressman's words quoted to me not long ago. this guy said to me, you know, I didn't realize that the job of a congressman was really to be friends with rich people.
But you seem to be, in a way, optimistic. You're predicting that the people who are trying to dismantle the government may be electorally dismantled in 2012.
If you read the polls closely, which admittedly is hard to do because it's very interesting that there isn't too much discussion of this, but there is a bit. You can see, that, for instance, the proposal not to give any more tax breaks to the upper 2% of the population, you know, is massively popular. That is to say, people don't want to do that tax cut for the rich. It's like in everybody's polls have it about 70% of the population against that. Moreover, you could see the swing. I think there's a lot of people have trouble reading the so-called Ryan budget. I mean, that's the House Republican alternative proposal. And it's just about for sure people don't yet realize that, in fact, it's not just going to cut spending or something, but it will absolutely sort of gut Medicare over time, not to mention Medicaid. But when they do, when the questions get close to those, you can see them in today's New York Times or in the Washington Post poll just a couple of days ago, they don't want to do it. People don't want to cut Medicare. They give you sort of, well, yes, we'd like to cut the size of government, but don't cut Medicare. Even there, somebody had one wonderful poll that even had Tea Party people, a very large number of them saying, hey, don't cut Social Security. And, you know, there's just zero support in this country for cutting Social Security. But all of this stuff is, of course, what's in the various proposals, both the Republican proposal, but also the Democratic counterproposals. And the president was signaling, I think, cryptically, but very clearly, that he was open to doing some cutting of Social Security. There's just no need to do that at all. The truth is that the population wants no part of this. And it's not clear to me how this will play out. In effect, what you're probably working toward, you got two money-driven parties. You're almost certainly working toward a position where the population doesn't really like either one of them. And you can see this with also the increasing negative ratings that Obama's got, but also nearly all the Republicans. I mean, this is a pretty strange political constellation we're sitting at. And in that sense, it's not clear to me that this is all going to go through. At the same time, you know, anybody who wants to disagree with me, it's not like I'm going to stand up and say, I'm obviously right. I'm sort of cautiously optimistic. I was quite struck the sort of almost careening car out of control way the electorate's been. You look over time in American politics, and if you measure, say, the number of seats a president loses in the off-year election that follows his own election, in other words, if you look at the difference from 208 to 210, you will find that actually the change in the balance of seats between the parties is about, I think, the second largest in modern times. And there was also a huge drop in turnout. That was clear. That was also clear that it hit especially the parts of the electorate that tend to support the Democrats, meaning the poor. That was evident to me when I did a study of Scott Brown's election, you know, over the Democrat in the Massachusetts Senate race, too. You could see how the traditionally heavy Democratic towns, the turnout was real light. You know, I would add, too, that the president's failure to deal with the mortgage and housing problem, I think, is really costing him. And you have a fairly serious problem in the United States. Housing prices are still trending down. And that's real trouble because it means that they're carried on the books of a lot of banks and stuff like that. I think later this year, it's this combination of high gas prices and home prices sliding still is a bigger problem than most people want to realize right now. Just watch. I mean, I have a fairly good record on actually tracking stuff like this. It's not perfect, but it's not bad. My sense is that you're in for more trouble here than people right now think. So I don't think we've seen the end of turbulent politics. I think there's a lot of funny things coming up in the next year or so.
But you seem to be saying that the reaction on the left will be more in terms of abstention than in opposition to this Democrat who you say rules like a liberal Republican.
It's kind of mixed case. I see very clear signs that the organized Democratic Party is trying to still all protest on the left of the Democratic Party. That process, I think, is quite clear. On the other hand, it's probably they probably lack the ability to completely succeed in that. And it's clear that the White House is thinking, in the end, everybody's going to rally around the president because, you know, he's got to be better than the Republicans. That, I mean, I would say, if you have to pick between them, sure, that's got to be right. You know, but now stepping back, what's the clinical assessment of turnout? I think that's quite open. I'm not persuaded that there will be sort of anything like the giant rally of popular support that carried this guy into office in 2008. And, you know, that was under a very almost perfect conditions from the standpoint of somebody running to overthrow the, not the incumbent, but the incumbent party, the Republicans, because you have the financial collapse right in the middle of it. He did just win by 5 or 6 points. I'm less persuaded than a lot of people that the president is an obvious candidate for re-election. I think he's vulnerable. And I think if the economy continues to slide, there might even be some thoughts in the Democratic Party of looking around. You know, nobody's going to say that now. The question is going to be, what's the unemployment rate in January? What are the gas? What's the price of gas? Are mortgage prices, housing prices still falling? That type of stuff is, you know, those will look like, you know, much thicker clouds on the horizon in January than they do now.
Professor Ferguson is a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
Washington, D.C.'s teachers union held a protest outside the Washington Post, charging the newspaper has a fundamental conflict of interest that keeps it from telling the truth about public education. Washington Teachers Union President Nathan Saunders explains.
What we wanted to do is send a message to the Washington Post editorial board in particular, to indicate to them that we were dissatisfied with the years of poor coverage of education and by their editorial board and the opinions that they have consistently come out with, which have, for the most part, been pro-Michelle Rhee without regard to other points of view, and pro-impact, which is a system of teacher evaluations in the District of Columbia, which relies heavily upon test scores and paper performance, which we are against.
And you've been saying that the Washington Post's editorial position, you believe, is influenced by the fact that the Washington Post owns Kaplan Higher Education, which specializes in that kind of testing.
Absolutely. Most people do not know of the direct relationship. And the direct relationship is not coincidental, nor is it incidental. The relationship is one in which the majority of the sustainability of the newspaper comes from Kaplan Higher Education. In fact, 60% of its resources. And Kaplan is not a small entity. It is an entity that is a multi-billion dollar enterprise, a for-profit educational entity, and it weighs heavily in our view, and it is our opinion, on the direction that the newspaper side goes. The Washington Post for a number of years has been attempting to imply that it plays no relationship it has no relationship. We do not believe so. We know that their executives on the editorial side, as well as the management side, have the ability to read financial statements. And to simply say that there's a firewall is a misnomer and a real disservice to the journalism industry that they are so heavily involved in.
It's like expecting them to ignore the elephant in the room, an elephant that, in fact, is bigger than the Washington Post revenues itself.
It is, and let's give you another parallel. If you subtracted Kaplan's resources, financial resources, from the Washington Post newspaper, they immediately go bankrupt. Immediately.
Now, there, in fact, is a relationship between almost all of the corporate media, basically all of the corporate media, and Wall Street. And Wall Street seems heavily invested in charterization of schools and in high-stakes testing.
Yes, very much so. And you know, I think that that's an important discussion that needs to be had in the sense that it's not able to be had in the large-scale media. It has to be independent media operations such as yours that talk about the real relationships. And the real relationships are those which are based upon the market agenda, privatization, charterization, vouchers, and things like that, where entities, for-profit entities, seek to preach a idea that market-driven approaches are the beginning and the end to all things that are good, which is simply not true. It's not true for journalism. It's not true for education. There are issues that are bigger than profitability that we need to address in arenas as journalism and education. Immediately, what we know is that market-driven approaches have a short-term appeal. The problem is when you need to sustain industries such as the education industry over a long period of time and need to show growth and sustainability, it doesn't work. And sure, you can get any firm to come in and to underbid another firm to provide services for a short period of time, whether it's a year or maybe 24 months. But when it comes to the long-term viability, whether providing educational services or newsprint or journalism services, it becomes harder. And there are values. All too often, the values of education get mixed up in issues of cost and profitability, and one side appears to outdistance the other side all too often in the short term, but the long term, they have a serious negative effect on the education arena. I'll give you a perfect example. It may look exceptionally exciting to look at costs associated with providing educational services in the area of teachers. Teachers, private sector teachers make less money than public sector teachers when you include pensions and things of that nature. But when you start to look at the fact that public sector teachers have no commitment or reliance on teaching certain technologies, Microsoft-based technology versus a PC-based technology or some other based technology. But when you start getting the private sector in there, they say, oh, yeah, and we're Microsoft and we're providing a grant and we only want you to use Microsoft computers and we only want you to use this or that. And the opinions start to become swayed, and oftentimes the private industry seek to sway those opinions in order to expand what the private sector knows as market share. We want everybody to use our product. We don't want people to even think about Apple products or some other product line. We want only the use of our products. And what we know is that when you get young minds and you only teach them one side of the coin, then you have a greater chance of doing that. And so we've got to look at making sure the values of diversity are preached in the public sector, and it's simply more difficult to do it when you have these market approaches only being looked at and considered.
If you advocate that education be run like a business, I guess it's a very short step, not even a leap, to say privatize.
No question about it, and that's what those are the words of the privatizers. First and foremost, it should be run like a business. You've heard it. You've heard them come in the door and say government should be run like a business. Well, all things that happen in the private sector and business aren't good things. For example, look at the housing industry. It was run like a business. It was run by Wall Street. And look what happened. Look at what would have happened if George Bush would have had the opportunity to run Social Security like a business and privatize it right before the markets crashed, due to largely to the housing bust and those problems. Imagine where this country would be. We think we're climbing out of recession now. I don't know if we would have been able to climb out of recession if those things were run like a business.
For decades, we've been hearing about the merits of public-private partnerships, but it seems inevitably these public-private partnerships tend to privatize the public sector.
That's pretty clear. We wanna come in and help you out, and before you know it, you get helped in the privatization. And let's be clear, let's be fair. There are some aspects of government that can possibly be privatized and possibly should be privatized. What we're concerned about is that they're not all aspects of government. They're not all aspects of education, and there certainly shouldn't be all aspects of journalism. Remember, when our founding fathers talked about the fourth estate of journalism and the free press being able to put pressure on government in order to make sure that working people and John Q. Citizen would have a fair share in our government, I don't know that they were ever envisioned a state in which thousands of independent news media sources would be constricted to less than maybe a dozen conglomerates that monopolize the news industry to a large extent across the United States.
One of the slogans the teachers were chanting at your demonstration was, "We'll stop buying the Washington Post until you stop lying." Have you any indications they'll stop lying anytime soon?
I have no indication that the Washington Post will stop lying. Unfortunately, we will continue to have to put pressure on the Washington Post, and we'll continue to have to focus on the issues and provide alternatives. We've got to provide alternatives in terms of education, information like independent media, small media, blogs, independent radios, independent writers such as yourself. We've got to support independent thought and free thought, and we've got to abandon those corporatized journalistic entities that only seem to be able to sell a point of view that's purchased by the highest bidder.
Nathan Saunders, president of the Washington Teachers Union.
Much of the left in the United States was in a state of high excitement over the huge labor actions in Madison, Wisconsin, some weeks ago. But Paul Street, author of the book The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power, says the euphoria was overblown.
Well, that Wisconsin moment, I think we got a little overexcited about it. I, like you, was out at the Left Forum in New York at Pace University, and was it March 19th, 20th? And I kept hearing people who'd never been there talk about Wisconsin. Wisconsin this, Wisconsin that. People from other parts of the country. There were statements coming in from Sweden and Finland and in Malaysia and Egypt as if there'd been this huge, massive left-wing revival in Wisconsin. Well, it was very exciting. I've been up there twice with my wife, Jen, and I've been up there two times. Actually, the first time when I was smaller was more exciting than the second time we went, March 12th, which was the biggest day they had up there, maybe 150,000, 170,000. But by that last time we went up there, it had seemed to have turned almost completely into a election rally for the Democratic Party. And this is no lie, I swear to God, I heard one of the Democrats outside the Capitol Rotunda in Madison say, "Time for you all to put down your protest signs and pick up your clipboards." Translation, all this mass direct action stuff was fun, but it's over now. It's about electoral activity. We're going to recall those Republicans who who passed this bill. We're going to recall Walker. There's also a whole thing about an election for the state Supreme Court right there that was related to this legislation. And it all just kind of went poof. a lot of this talk that there was very early on, it was very exciting that we picked up on the first time we went there, which was February 19th, about a general strike gone. A lot of this early energy had to come from, came from the Madison teachers, who on their own went out there and engaged in some direct action and had a bunch of sick days, kind of amounted to a short-term general strike on their own part, and they helped drive events from the bottom up to some extent there. Even though the first time I went, it was smaller. It was more fluid. It felt more radical. It was more of a sense of direct action. By the last time I went there, was so many people there. They're all just kind of milling around. It was a swirling mass of humanity. But the sense of militancy was eroding. And that was the last big rally they've had up there. And it's too bad, because if they think that just getting Democrats back in is going to fix that situation up there, they're wrong. Democratic governors are going after public workers' benefits and salaries in the state of New York, and in the state of California and other Democratic-controlled states, and at the federal level, there's a federal politician named Barack Obama and an in-power Democratic administration there that's put a pay freeze on public workers up there at the same time that they're extending tax cuts for the very wealthy. And one of the unfortunate things about the Madison thing is, Wisconsin thing is, well, I'm glad they hit the streets. I really am. It's a good thing that they hit the streets and occupied the legislative halls and did all those kinds of things. But we need to find the capacity in our labor movements and our social movements to do that in jurisdictions that are under the control of Democrats, not just maximalist far-right Republicans. It's easy to hate Republicans. It's more difficult to come to have a real confrontation with the other state capitalist austerity parties, the Democrats. I don't see willingness to do that in California and New York right now. I only see it in Republican states. Not only that, it's not just Wisconsin that had a Republican governor that did terrible things. It's also Ohio, where a far right-wing proto-fascist capitalist Koch brother-funded governor named John Kasich, or Kasich, passed a bill that's about every bit as bad as what Walker's been trying to get through there, except it affects more workers, 350,000 public sector workers. They didn't have a movement there that was one-tenth of what they had in Madison. There's a far-right-wing, racist, proto-fascist governor in Michigan, and while he's not going directly after public sector worker unions yet, all he's done is pass a bill that gives so-called emergency financial managers the power, essentially, to take over school boards, like in Detroit, and whole municipalities, like in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and elsewhere, and abrogate all the existing union contracts and social programs, such contracts and programs that still exist for working people. And again, in Michigan, while there's been protests, also in Indiana and elsewhere, they've been on scale, man. They're a little over-focused on Wisconsin, I think.
The Michigan situation sounds almost like a kind of martial law over labor.
I would say that. In fact, one of the Republican state legislators there approvingly referred to Seymour's bill, or is it Snyder? I'll just have to correct you later, as financial martial law. And he liked it. And, you know, of course, they're going to impose this, especially on cities with high per capita minority, people of color. And it's all going to be part of this narrative. These folks are just, you know, these municipalities are too dysfunctional. You know, Ann Arbor's too dysfunctional. Detroit's too dysfunctional. And so I guess these great white overlords of finance have to be put in dictatorial martial law control and make decisions for them.
No sooner have we experienced a crisis in terms of the status of labor in this country, but another front has opened in Obama's wars.
Yeah, Obama's now got I heard this a lot. They said his first non-inherited war. It's all his own. He owns it, right? Because Afghanistan and Iraq were passed on to him. But I always do say, well, be careful, because he stepped up some stuff in Somalia and Yemen as well. There were some strikes there that I think he kind of put a stamp on that weren't really inherited. I mean, the whole war on terror thing is an inherited structure. It's the post-Cold War framework of American imperialism. But yeah, that was this kind of baby. And, you know, one thing I haven't seen enough mentioned about it is how quickly that knocked Wisconsin and the public sector workers' struggle off the front page of the news and off the prime time, and help kick him to the back, and also, I would say, help kick the Egyptian Revolution, which is a very incomplete process. It's funny how they covered that all up to the point that they got rid of Mubarak, and they didn't have much to say about it anymore after we basically got Mubarakism without Mubarak in the form of a military dictatorship. You know, and the repression that's going on in Saudi Arabia and the repression that's going on in Bahrain, all those things got knocked out by Libya, which is, of course, sold to us as a humanitarian intervention in the mode of Bill Clinton, supposedly, in the Balkans. And we've got Samantha Power playing a key role in there, the great humanitarian interventionist. And it's no such thing. It's no such thing at all. It's what Obama is acting on the same imperative as what U.S. Middle East policy has always been about, from before and back to Jukdot, back to Roosevelt and up through Truman and up to this day. Oil. It's about oil control. I think what they're looking at is a partition, of Libya. I think that's what they're looking at. You know, and if they can't completely take it out, I mean, I love this whole language that this is just to protect these people. It's not saying that on the one side of their mouth, the other side of their mouth, making it clear. You know, Hillary says this again and again, the solution would be if Gaddafi would go. And what that's saying is this really is regime change. This really is about regime change. It's not just a protective measure. But even if they can't get him out of there completely, they have the resources to do it. And, of course, in this case, they're working very strongly with England and France, much more so than Iraq. And that's a difference. In some way, England and France are driving this first. I think Europe actually depends more directly on Libyan oil than the United States. But in any event, if they can't drive him out there completely, they're going to try and contain him in the least oil-rich parts of Libya and keep the most oil-rich parts of Libya essentially as a neocolonial free exploitation zone for Western capitalism.
And it doesn't appear that they're going to allow these rebels and their so-called transitional regime to actually take power even in that part of eastern Libya. We hear President Obama talking about how the country doesn't have institutions and it's going to be a very long time before it's ready for sovereignty.
And in that interim period, we'll just happen to increase our rate of oil exploitation there and deepen our control of that. You know, it's not always just. A lot of times, what you hear on the left, a lot of leftists say it's all about getting that oil and putting in our SUVs, direct exploitation. If you actually look at the U.S. foreign policy documents, the main concern that the United States has always had, and this goes back to World War II with the Middle Eastern oil, is the control of it. Actually, other advanced industrial, well, now we're post-industrialized, but other advanced capitalist states in the core of the world capital system probably depend more, quantitatively more on Middle Eastern oil than we do. We depend on it significantly, but we also have oil sources in the New World, in the African coast. But the control of it in the classic American foreign policy documents, going back to George Kennan, the great advisor to Roosevelt and Truman, where that this is that if we can control, if we can exercise predominant influence over the oil regimes over there, we will have a veto power on the political economies of our competitor states, by which they mean Japan and Germany and the rest of the industrialized world. And I think that's undoubtedly what's going on here. I do think they didn't want a massacre in Benghazi, not because they care about human lives. They don't. They killed 3 million people in Iraq since 2003. They've blown up whole families and children in towns like Bola Bulak in Afghanistan. And I care about human lives. But I do think that would have been blamed on Washington to some extent that there had been a massacre there. And might have compelled them to impose an oil embargo, which they really don't want to do given the current state of the global economy. But all the humanitarianism is always, if you look at the classic foreign policy documents, what people like George Kennan and Zbigniew Brzezinski are always telling policymakers is you need to practice an imperial policy that won't be acceptable to the American populace or the populace of Russia. You need to sell it as being about democracy and humanitarianism, even though you know it's no such thing.
And for this reason, I believe that Libya will follow the Haitian model of a kind of protectorate under some kind of quasi-international auspices, possibly the UN, but possibly some jerry-rigged Saudi-led Arab League formation.
That makes a whole lot of sense to me, yeah. Yeah, and it'll just sort of be kept in a perpetual state of paralysis and confusion, but the resources will continue to be exploited with great efficiency. One thing I would say that's different with the Iraq invasion, sometimes I hear the analogies going too extreme in that regard. as there really was, it was kind of, the invasion of Iraq was really considered an inter-imperialist zero-sum game as far as Germany, France, Italy. This thing has a little bit more of a flavor of ultra-imperialism, or sort of imperialist unity, where sort of the entire West, particularly France and England in this case, are really sort of on board with this. And I think that's part of why Europe loves Obama so much, is that he's a little more attentive to the, frankly, imperialist designs and needs and desires of the European states, and wants to sort of work in harmony with them. Bush really didn't just mind completely pissing off the French and the Germans, and engaging in just a totally unilateral, American-style imperial adventure. Obama's being slicker, more sophisticated, in doing something, quote-unquote, multilaterally.
And showing the lesser imperialists some respect.
He's showing the lesser imperialists some respect, yeah. You know, at the end of the day, though, once he commits, and this is something that leftists sometimes underestimate. Noam Chomsky writes brilliantly and talks brilliantly about it. So whatever the strategic objective might have been, or is, what, even if there was only an actual hint of actual humanitarian concern, or just about oil, doesn't matter what it is, it's a political consideration, why they're going in. Once the mafia don goes in and commits itself, and they've committed themselves now, I think, to Gaddafi, having to be severely blooded or probably to leave, given some of the things they're saying. If they can't look bad, they can't look weak. The big mafia don, and that's what the U.S. and that's what Uncle Sam is on the global stage. That's how he's understood around the world as the biggest, baddest mafia boss of all. Once he goes in, he's got to follow through no matter what. But he can't have some little punk like Gaddafi making him look bad.
That was author Paul Street.
Milton Alamadi, publisher of the New York-based newspaper Black Star, traveled to Libya in January. Alamadi recently lectured on the theme, 50 years after Uhuru, who owns Africa? Clearly, it's not the Africans, and he says the attack on Libya shows it.
We read about popular uprising. The New York Times refers to it as a popular uprising. It is so popular that we don't see much of an uprising in Tripoli, if you've noticed that, and in Western Libya. It is so popular that every time a rocket drops amongst the rebels, they jump back in their vehicles and head straight back to Benghazi. That's how popular this uprising is. In fact, I have made the argument that had there been the possibility, and had there been some authentic uprising germinating in Libya, that itself has been destroyed and hijacked by this aggressive, greedy, malicious, and vicious Western agenda and design on Libya. They're so keen to rescue innocent civilians in Libya that they're now sending foreign military advisors from Britain and France to rescue civilians in Libya. They're so keen to rescue civilians in Libya that they're allowing a government that does not exist in Benghazi to export oil with an agreement with Qatar, even though there is an existing United Nations sanction, which they themselves manipulated and got. I've never heard of a sanction against a country that only applies to parts of one country and does not apply to parts of the same country. They're so eager to rescue civilians in Libya that they're smuggling arms to Benghazi through Qatar and through Egypt. And yet, the whole world is witnessing this helplessly and not doing anything. We don't see much demonstration in the streets of Paris. We don't see much demonstration in the streets of London. We don't see much demonstration in the streets here in the United States. So I introduce my comments with Libya simply to show and juxtapose the scene of the place where I was just a few weeks ago and then what is occurring today. And all this still fits under the theme of this presentation. 50 years after Uhuru, who really owns Africa? And I think to me, the debacle or crises, whatever you call it, in Libya and in the Ivory Coast that Brother Bernard White also brought up, are two very vivid examples. They are so set on the agenda, which is to take control of this immense wealth, $44 billion in known oil reserves. If all the oil that exists in the ground in Libya were to be sold today, each and every Libyan citizen, 6.5 million citizens, would be able to get a check of in excess of $500,000. That's how wealthy that country is. And it's important to put it in perspective to show you how preposterous and how nonsensical. And yet we accept this nonsense. Obviously, I'm not talking about us, the conscious, the willing, but the rest of the world, when they insult our intelligence and insist that this is a mission to save the lives of innocent Libyans. It is nauseating and it is revolting. The African Union came up with a plan and said the solution would be a ceasefire. Create a humanitarian corridor to bring relief to people in distressed cities such as Misrata. And then to have a political dialogue to negotiate and to come up with the new dispensation for this country. What was the reaction? The reaction initially was to insist on getting UN resolution 1973 to create the no-fly zone, meaning that the five heads of states that were designated by the African Union to go and mediate could not even go to Libya because they could not fly with the existing no-fly zone, knowing full well that Sarkozy could decide to have them their plane shot down. So they did not go. The aerial attacks began. The U.S. was still involved, so the Tomahawk missiles were launched. And the expectation was that the Gaddafi regime would crumble probably overnight. Because if we recall, the British Foreign Secretary, Haig, said he had heard somewhere that Gaddafi was already on a plane to Venezuela. And I think that was not just said unconsciously. They were giving him a very strong hint that if you're not yet on that plane, you should be on that plane soon. But obviously that was more than 2 months ago. I think they underestimated. I think they generally believe that there would be an uprising even in Tripoli. That has not happened yet. So when the bombardment continued and they realized that, wait, we need to go through the superficial formality of allowing the African Union team to go to Libya because, Gaddafi had not yet fled. On the contrary, the Libyan army had pushed back the And it's hard to call them rebels because you have a definition of rebels. I've never heard of a popular rebel movement that is trained by the Central Intelligence Agency that is also allied with elements of Al-Qaeda. That includes monarchists, including the son of King Idris, and then the intellectuals. This seems to me a very peculiar combination and construct. So I feel like genuine rebels might feel offended if I refer to them as rebels. So let's just say opponents of Gaddafi. The opponents of Gaddafi have been pushed back from cities that they had seized, further back to Benghazi, and that's when they realized, let's go through the motion of allowing the African Union to be involved superficially. And it goes back again to the theme, 50 years after Uhuru, who really owns Africa? When five African presidents need permission from NATO to fly to an African country to mediate a civil war. Well, obviously, they did not want to take the real risk of being shot down, so they did secure that permission. And they made sure it was broadcast that they had permission to fly to Libya. And then they flew to Libya. They met with Gaddafi, and it was reported that he accepted the proposal. And then from there, they flew to Benghazi, except for the leader of the delegation, President Jacob Zuma of South Africa. He didn't go. He went back to South Africa. But the rest of the delegation went to Benghazi. And not surprisingly, that plan was rejected. Why would Benghazi accept such a proposal? That would include a ceasefire, and a real ceasefire, not the kind of ceasefire that the UN was demanding on. Not really the UN, because the UN has been usurped. In fact, when we talk about the UN, what do we really mean? The US. You wonder why we even need to have a UN Secretary General when we have a United States Secretary of State. Really. But they did go, and they went to Benghazi, and that plan was rejected. And it's not surprising, because why would Benghazi accept such a plan when they realize that France and Britain are willing to do their fighting for them? And it's quite clear. It's in the newspapers. Every time 10, 12, 15 rounds of artillery is fired against the Gaddafi opponents, they run back to Benghazi, and then they start complaining about NATO not doing its job. In fact, there was a very explicit article today by one of the generals leading the Gaddafi opponents, who said he wants NATO to be clear. He says, when I'm leading the attack, I want NATO to give me overhead cover. Said, yes, the UN resolution was for the no-fly zone to be enforced in order to protect civilians. But the best way to protect civilians is to give me air cover so we can overthrow Gaddafi. And that would be the ideal way to protect civilians. And they're going to push as far as they can. They will. They're determined. Because where is the public reaction? It's not there. Not in Europe. Not here in the United States. It involves Africa, after all. It involves Gaddafi, after all. And among the vast public, there's a certain perception and tolerance of what have you when it comes to Africa. And these are the kind of challenges that we are fighting against.
Black Star newspaper publisher Milton Alamadi speaking at New York's Brecht Forum.
Black Agenda reports Dr. Jared Ball has been taking a critical look at Manny Marable's new biography of Malcolm X.
Manny Marable titles his book's epilogue Reflections on a Revolutionary Vision. However, his conclusion is more of a eulogy for the revolutionary ideas so carefully put to permanent rest throughout its preceding pages. Manning Marable's Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, positions itself alongside, if not atop, a previous work by Marable's protege, Peniel Joseph, as a well-written and hard-to-target missive clearly designed to popularize without implementation radical ideas and by so doing destroy them. Throughout the book, Malcolm's constantly deepening and progressive struggle with armed resistance, white supremacy, socialism, pan-Africanism, and even the power of the vote are softened by Marable in ways to support what has now become the only way to discuss radical ideas, riddled with scandal and distorted by selective emphasis. Marable's conclusion is the dead giveaway. The overall tone of the book is simply foreplay to its repackaging of Malcolm's political trajectory into marketable liberal politics of the post-9/11 book publishing world. Malcolm's biting, insightful criticism of electoral politics and neo-colonial black elected officials is repackaged into that which anticipated the power of the black electorate to deliver Barack Obama. Malcolm's increasing devotion to Sunni Islam and his persistent support of the Mau Mau, even a similar effort within the United States, is re-imaged, absent context or critique, into a condemnation of Islamic terrorism. Malcolm's explicit post-Mecca views on race, that the white man here had not changed, so nor would he, and that John Brown remained his standard of white activism, is lost beneath repeated descriptions of his moving toward views that are race-neutral, and support for anti-imperial struggles around the globe are rewritten as gentle humanism. Marable carefully crafts a narrative that promotes Malcolm's political changes paternalistically as maturation and consistent with the world we face today. So other than Barack Obama and Al-Qaeda, which serve as ideological goalposts between good and evil, the only contemporary reference Marable makes is to the 2001 World Conference Against Racism, which he alleges was in many ways a fulfillment of Malcolm's international vision. Obama becomes the safe expression of Malcolm's black nationalist control over politics, and Al-Qaeda become the anti-hero required to safely place Malcolm's continued move toward Orthodox Islam. The 2001 conference provides Marable with a timely balance which conveniently allows him to use Malcolm as a Muslim to condemn 9/11. But if Malcolm spoke of chickens coming home to roost over Kennedy, would this really be his position? Such questions are only raised to make a current political point. Otherwise, we might be more accurate to say that had Malcolm lived, the world would be radically different. 9/11 would have never happened, and we would all be living in an African-centered socialist utopia. Here Marable becomes William Styron, who in the late 1960s gave an interview praising Nat Turner while condemning Rap Brown. Radicalism is fine once dead and buried, but it has no place in the present. But no mention is made of the Durban 2 conference, where the world gathered to decry the absence of progress made since 2001. But Obama refused to acknowledge this one, just as Bush had the first, and for similar reasons, equally inconvenient for Marable. Malcolm's anti-Zionism is easily dismissed as the negative influence of Nkrumah and Nasser. Its contemporary detractors have no such easily dismissed dead targets. But major publications on such potentially threatening topics like Malcolm X and his ideas must make logically fallacious leaps like those in Marable's conclusion. Malcolm X is the antithesis of Obama, not part of the president's political lineage. The very question of Malcolm's thoughts in 2011 demand that we accept the political impossibility of 2011 existing as it does with a living Malcolm X. This world exists because he and his ideas were and are in perpetuity assassinated. I am not likely to say much more about Marable's book. My obsession with it will soon pass. But as I close, I am reminded of what someone once said not long ago about being careful to distinguish between who you read and who governs your interpretation of what is read.
Dr. Jared Ball of Morgan State University and an editor at Black Agenda Report.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.